Pushers Podcast. Podcast where engineers get together to talk about work life in the networking industry. Today we are coming to you in a special from Network Field Day. We're in a room. We've got about just about all of the delegates are here. We're pre-beer and post-vendor. And that means that we're probably a little bit antsy, a little bit nervous, but we wanted to record something, talk about our experiences. We had a short podcast yesterday, which you'll find in the Priority Queue feed, where we talked a little bit about what StatSeek was doing. And today what we wanted to do is talk about what we saw, not for any particular reason, because some of it was interesting and there's lots of stuff to talk about as a result of that. And if there's time at the end, we might actually spend some time flapping our gums about some of the things that have happened this week. I don't know. Should we go around the table? Why don't we start with everybody who goes around and introduces themselves and mentions your Twitter handle and your blog. So starting with you.
I'm Bob Plankers, the Lone Sysadmin, just lonesysadmin.net. I'm at Plankers on Twitter.
John Herbert, at Mr. Tugs on Twitter, and it's lanejournal.com.
Brent Salisbury, at Network Static and at networkstatic.net.
Michael McNamara, at MF McNamara, blog.michaelfmcnamara.com.
Anthony Burke, at pandem underscore, and I'm blog.ciscoinferno.net.
I am Chris Margett, and I'm at Chris Margett, and fragmentationneeded.net.
Tom, the networking nerd. Twitter handle is at networking nerd. My blog is networkingnerd.net.
Colin McNamara, that'd be the second McNamara in the room. Blog is colinmcnamara.com, and Twitter handle is at Colin McNamara.
Paul Stewart, Twitter handle is at PacketU, and blog is www.packetu.com.
John Harrington, Twitter handle is at Network Sherpa, and blog at thenetworksherpa.com.
And as always, I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com, and on the Twitters is at etherealmind. So to kick off the first topic, this morning we went out to see Spirent. For those of you who don't know who Spirent is a testing company that's been around for quite a long time, something like 15 years or more, and they've built themselves up into a $1 billion company. What's perhaps unique about their positioning, and if you go and see the videos on Vimeo that we upload, so as we do Netfield Day, if you haven't seen it before, we actually live stream the videos. We record all of the sessions, and then they're uploaded onto Vimeo for you to look at later on. I think they're on YouTube as well.
Yes, they're on YouTube first.
YouTube first? Yeah, I didn't know that.
Vimeo has a quota. YouTube doesn't, so up for them.
So you can actually watch most of the videos that we're talking about today. So I want to kick it off first. In the last few weeks, Spirent has been talking to me about a product called Axon. In the past, Spirent has been making these bus-sized load generators, right? and they come with a price tag that's, you know, fairly generously sized, but they are a fully dedicated, all knobs, all singing, all dancing, high-kicking load generation devices, and they do an amazing set of stuff. But they've come out with an Axon, which is this new product targeting at the enterprise. It'll be a while before it hits the mainstream. They've not quite yet released it, but they're able to brief us about it. I know you do a lot of work on them, John. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I guess I've used their competitor. I've used Ixia in the past, and we kind of need to, twiddle all the knobs of OSPF and the protocol and the combination of sending traffic and, you know, injecting prefixes. I guess it was hard for me to see the value in the Axon because I guess it's not really targeted at the type of testing that I'm doing. It's kind of targeted at the enterprise. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, there's probably people in the room it's kind of more targeted at. I mean, it seemed very good because they've really taken the UI seriously. They've actually made a real effort into making the UI.
I love that playlist.
Yeah,
well, you actually take a playlist of traffic and then press play, and it actually runs a traffic generator.
Yeah,
it looks like a Mac OS app. It's beautiful.
Well, at first it seemed a little bit it's a bit it seemed a little childish at first, but it's actually very well structured. It's not cheesy. It makes sense. It's logical.
But it's childish for a reason, because, I mean, think about the first time you opened Wireshark. It was like sensory overload. There were so many knobs and buttons and switches and bells and whistles, you didn't know what you wanted to do with the app. And this way, they hide all of that behind a layer of abstraction, and they say, guess what? You can do really awesome stuff by drag here, drop here, and click play. And then you can take the output of that device, feed it to whatever you want, and say, okay, this is what we got out of it.
Well, I think they're taking a very similar path to what a lot of the open source projects have been doing. I mean, you look at tools like LoadUI and whatnot, you know, frankly looks the same. And what they've been able to marry it to is this big complicated bus sized gear which can, you know, eat packets and crap frames, you know. And it's nice to put a human readable interface, human usable interface on the front of it.
But you do lose some of the complexity behind it as a result, so it's, I don't know if I call it dumbed down, but it is, you can only go a certain depth, I think, from what they're saying before, well, if there isn't a button for it, tough. And the other compromises were made, like, you know, the level of resolution of time, because it's built to a price, right? So you're talking millisecond resolution, not nanosecond on the bus-sized products. Yeah. But for the market, I mean, I think it seems pretty well targeted.
But honestly, when I look at network ready for use testing in a data center, frankly, while I'll measure it to 10 millisecond slices, is, you know, really start characterizing thing in 100 millisecond slices and finding, you know, is it, you know, 250 milliseconds, 500 milliseconds, 750, you know, 1,000, really. In those ranges, I don't care about a millisecond. It's really not that important to, I think, the testing that most of us do.
Right. I've used the very expensive test center in an enterprise environment for validation of data center designs and validating reconvergence times and device capacity and things like that. And it was an expensive box that came with a guy. Mm-hmm. It was a big project. And, you know, there was nothing that we did that couldn't have been done with the white box hardware approach they're introducing now. And, you know, their stuff is fabulous. The resolution and the capacity and the precision that they offer and the full size stuff is amazing. But, you know, most enterprises aren't test labs and really don't need all that.
Well, they may not be buying. They're selling into markets, I think, that this is aimed at markets that they're not selling into right now, you know. Like,
right.
Because, well, you know, enterprise folks don't need that sort of thing, and they don't know what to do with all the knobs, so they just don't end up buying it. Well,
but this is what we needed.
Yeah, you know, now it looks like a tape deck. We can stack on, you know, all kinds of different stuff and, you know, hit play, and, yeah, cool.
So
tape deck, what are those?
And it's about a sixth of the price.
Yeah, you know.
Well, plus licensing.
Yeah, you know,
we'll
price
see, we will see where that goes when they announce that, right?
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing because they offer either the hardware platform or the VM platform, and it's very interesting how they've re-architected the timing mechanism to support VM hardware, and from further digging from what we were finding today, it is any hypervisor. So that's always a bonus as well. So if you are in my situation, I am in enterprise, there's a number of finger pointing like kids amongst third parties, your fault, my fault, whose fault is it? And normally you run Escapee or something really dirty to find where the packet, how to generate something, whereas this, being a relatively cheap price and the ongoing, is something I can instantly, quickly point a finger and say, no, it's not our problem, that you fix it, you two kids talk, because it's not us. And it's something that I've struggled with for a long time. So it's filling a niche, it's not filling a niche, it's pretty filling a wide market. Yeah. And I think you'll find, once the first few get out there, you'll have a big uptake.
Well, I think the enterprise is where, like, network management and, you know, these networking applications go to die. Because how often does a typical enterprise buy something, it looks great on paper, and then it gets there and you never use it? So I think the simplicity of it's pretty cool. I still think getting this data and then doing something with it to be a little bit more proactive than reactive, which is where we've been forever with such a limited tool set that we have. But overall, I like the UI.
So. Yeah, in general, enterprises won't buy anything until they've been burned. I've been there. Until you've been hacked, until you've been whatever. Then you go buy an IDS IPS. You go buy, you know, a subscription
the
to the...
Is gone.
So yeah,
gone.
You know. So in this case, if something, you know, if there's a performance problem, you go look for a tool that can address it. And for enterprises, I mean, for those guys that don't, they don't understand all the knobs and dials. They're not, you know, the town in this room. Those guys don't get all that. They need really, you know, hey, green or not so green, and if not so green, call vendor, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Anybody get a clear understanding of the appliance offering versus the VM offering? Is it pretty much the same deal? Or
The VM offerings, they're not able to give you the same sort of guarantees on the hardware because they understand what hardware is going in.
Sure.
So specifically in the motherboard, because of the Intels and the Intel chipsets that drive the network adapters, they actually know the latencies and all that type of stuff, so they can have much more fine-grained control.
I imagine they'll have a compatibility list. And
I think what they're waiting on is the network card implementation that they talked about toward the end of the presentation, where instead of having to ship you a box, they can ship you a plug-in module, and you know what? Doesn't matter what hardware you're running on at that point, because it's all one self-contained unit.
Server and go, you know.
Yeah.
This is the Spiron on NIC, the Sonic, right?
Yeah.
Sonic.
With CPU and RAM on the card. I mean, great idea. You go plug it in, go for it.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of ways they'll take it. It'll just depend on how the market and, you know, the take-up and so forth.
This is just to put in the market to get people talking about it while they figure out what's the next step.
Yes.
Well, I say the market between the hardware and the software, being the hardware, you have to put a box in your backpack, run around as a VAR to a customer, and kill their network, do whatever you want to their network, test it to the buggery, and you've got what you need. Whereas the VM would work in a situation where you're a permanent static place, and you can allow for that difference. And so, in fact, you can walk around with a portable traffic generator. It's not 11 RU; it's 2 RU, and it's a box, and you can.
It'll actually be 1 RU when it comes out. It's about the size of an old Netgear switch.
Yeah,
the old one. Six inches by 5 inches.
Well, one on the table was 2 or whatever it was.
So the use case I had in mind is that most enterprises have a gigabit pipe to the internet, and what you want to do is run traffic through your firewall. Let's say you're running an ASA or a Juniper or something. You want to know it will run at a gig. You don't really need to know it running at 2 or 5 or 10 because you've only got 1 gig to the internet. But what you're running through the firewall is X amount of email, X amount of IPsec, X amount of SSL VPNs, X amount of, you know, web traffic coming from your proxy server. So you can just go in and build up a profile for that, put it on either side of your firewall and run it. And if it doesn't break, you can say, good, ready to go. That's all I want. You know, or, you know, the guy says, I want to test my email server to find out how much mail it can send. If your email server can get to 300 megabits per second of emails, that's good enough, you know, because that's a hell of a lot of email. You don't need to run gigabits per second.
I love the firewall aspect is great, because if you look at the spec sheets on, you know, they're so inflated. Oh, yeah, this will do 100 gig in the lab with a particular MTU, when in reality it's 450 byte MTU times packet per second.
So an ASA firewall application inspection on HTTP enabled has a maximum performance of about 70 megabits per second when I last tested them about 3 years ago. I'm sure it's better today. But, you know, you can only run HTTP inspection in a policy for a very small set of traffic before it blows up, and I've blown up a few ASAs that way.
You mean you don't run your production firewalls with one UDP rule?
64 byte packets.
I had an ACE module set, the Cisco ACE, 16 gigabits per second, balls to the wall, turned on DNS inspection, maximum throughput's under 200 megabits per second. The DNS inspection rule turned on. Found out the hard way when we got to 200 megabits per second for a carrier on the DNS through the load balance. We had to turn off inspection, and that fixed it. And that this would have validated that. We would have found that. We would have seen the profiles go up. So the second thing that we looked at the Spirit, and it was a couple of things. What we're really doing is just picking out the key topics, is the iTest Lab. The key thing about testing, if you've ever done much testing, is automation. You've got to be able to do it again and again and again. And then you've got to be able to compare what you did, and after you made a change, and then after you made another change, and then the vendor says, oh, yeah, we know that the DNS doesn't work, so we'll send you some new special code that's supposed to solve it, and then it doesn't. That's never happened, has it?
No.
And then you get another version of code that's almost working until it blows up when you run the test. So you have to keep running the tests over and over. So lab automation is actually quite important. And they showed it was iTest Lab. Did I get that right?
iTest,
Just sort of iTest.
Well, that was an
iTest Lab Optimizer.
That's right. And what I thought was cool about that was it was like looking at GNS3, but it was the back end of it was your real hardware. So, I mean, you sort of draw out your network or the pieces of the puzzle, and you connect them together, and it looks like GNS3. So, you know, people understand that, but it's actually running the real hardware on the back end.
Right, and it was going beyond as well just being able to repeat one specific topology. It was into the whole, how do you schedule lab time? You reserve the lab, you book it, and by the way, I need a different physical topology for this. Okay, well, I'll talk to a layer one switch, and I'll reroute your connections between the devices, and so long as it's available, click go, and it'll build it for you.
Yeah, you didn't need to book the lab. You just need to book the interfaces you need or the devices you need.
Well, I think one thing that's, you know, a lot of times when you have to fund labs in a business is that you actually have to show the business impact of it, track what users have used it, and ideally figure out what business it drove, right? Whether it's a change control or selling something for those that sell stuff to people. The notion of having basically a service catalog for your lab infrastructure to be able to document, like, hey, we've invested in all these tools for our company, and look, people are actually using it.
Yeah.
It's not just sitting here in this dusty cold room.
It'd be pretty cool to have a vendor come in. So if you're a reseller and you've got a lab in the back, and the vendor comes in and says, you can actually print out a thing and say, well, X number of people were using this in our lab, we want to keep it. Here's the use chart.
Well, I mean, I just did that a month ago, so I had to buy a new physical layer switch. And what I did is, I use a competitive product. So there's a couple of other competitors in the market. There's Quali Systems, And then there's like Gale Force Lab Manager, which has basically been around for the longest time. But basically you go through that, the equivalent tool, yeah. and you run your report, and you say, these 10 internal teams are using this, here's a snapshot from today, and it was something like 20 different people had topologies running at any one time, and that's a business case. That's an instant business case. We're running out of capacity, we need more of the physical air switch, but the argument carries equally to devices under test.
Mm-hmm.
Once you solve the problem of making your lab devices readily available to your lab users without the barrier of patching, repatching, and you can do it dynamically, I mean, the efficiency argument, it's actually... It's real. It's not just marketing. It works. You know, you get the use out of it.
And you save money because, you know, if you set up a bigger physical lab, you end up having to have a lab operations team to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like we said when we talked earlier, you know, you tend to have the lab manager who's the one who holds the keys and doesn't let you in, because their job is to do the repatching and to...
So stop engineers from stealing the equipment and taking it out to the customer.
Spares pool.
That would never happen. If you don't have to pay for a team, you can actually buy more equipment. What the heck?
Yeah. Absolutely.
You stop that by putting your lab completely full of 2511s and 3524XLs.
Yeah.
Now you're describing the Open Gear Lab.
Yeah, the Open Gear. Well, that's a good tweak. We had a presentation yesterday. We haven't talked about that. The Open Gear. What did everybody think about the Open Gear Lab last month?
I love salmon.
The use case is fantastic. There are so many applications, and with that, correct me, what, the board on the side, it allows the input and output of electricity so you can control other things.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many use cases, and one example was...
It's not a controller, it's a monitor.
A monitor, sorry.
So what it does is it detects 5 volts up or 0 volts.
But it can also trip stuff too.
It can generate voltage.
Because you can open doors, close doors, you can monitor that sort of thing. But I think one of the use cases, which I think we all were astounded at, was an RFID sensor onto a salmon farm. Mm-hmm. And just, we all sat there and we all
joked floating around going, on the ocean somewhere, you know.
Yeah,
like,
and then they got them on the buoys, NOAA buoys.
Yeah, they're just, that they've got a lot of product floating in the Atlantic, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah, yourself, you've got a plan for yours, and that's
something totally different,
and it's not what it's intended to be designed for, but it's great.
Yeah, well, you've got a... You know, it's marketed as like a little remote access gateway, but it's really just a general purpose Linux box with a decent web interface for administration and a cell modem in it and all kinds of crazy stuff. It's this very flexible thing. You know, even the fact that they added GPS capabilities to it, you know, well, they didn't add it. They just, you know, it's part of the chipset. They just enabled it, you know, so you can use one of the antennas as a GPS a GPS antenna, and you've got a Stratum Zero time NTP time source now.
I said yesterday
that runs on 12 volts in my Jeep. You know, like,
I'm looking forward to your Jeep joining Foursquare.
it's a Raspberry Pi on steroids.
Yeah, basically.
So I think Colin said it was like an Arduino. It is. It's like an Arduino with a lot of options on it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I picked it up. You know, I was looking at it, and you know, my barbecue at Net BBQ. You know, it tweets its temperature. I tweet my meat, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the whole. Wow. Well, my barbecue.
I tweet my meat.
That's what Tumblr's for.
Yeah.
We have the show title.
Yes. Okay. But you know, one thing, I'm a huge proponent of useful use of open source technologies. It's great to have something that's free, but to actually put it in a packaged, consumable way. You know, look at UC Linux being used inside of here, being flexible. You look at the different network power manager tools. A lot of the functionality that came out of there is not only by utilizing this open source code that's out here. One thing I was really impressed with is that they're contributing back. So, you know, they're really stimulating and supporting an ecosystem while creating a product that I think what they showed to us has, you know, a range of uses outside of the, great, we're going to talk about console servers today.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's, so over the past year, we've seen boxes that are starting to ship, small profile boxes, that, you know, NEMA enclosures, outdoor type things for video, you know, that emergency phones that are in the middle of a field that you can't, or outside of 300 feet to pick up PoE power. I think they separate themselves, to your point, with it's Unix, it's Linux under the hood. So not only do I have something that can pick up a cellular signal, it can pick up wired, it can pick up wireless, But now I've also got this shell out there, and I can put whatever I want on. Anything you can roll onto Linux, you can now roll as a remote
application.
That's
right, the box had four serial console ports, four Ethernet ports, a Wi-Fi, a pair of Wi-Fis,
a USB port. To connect whatever you want to it. You know?
And they give you root access.
A 3G, yep. They give you root access. They have environmental controls in certain models.
GPS.
Script.
You can do temperature.
You can put your own firmware on it. I mean, you can totally redo that box.
Yeah. Yeah. But the built-in stuff is so flexible with all the scripting options.
And the power monitoring stuff as well. They've actually
It can receive and natively deal with SMS messages. You can text it to open a door or, you know, like
you can text it to bring it online.
Yeah.
Those things are the use cases I think are so interesting as the ones that are scripted in. I mean, the fish farm is cool, but that's bolting a serial port to the 3G, which is exactly what we might want to do for console servers. It seems like an obvious use case to me. Mm. But, you know, the examples of who opened the utility cabinet out in the field.
Yeah.
And, you know, a camera takes a picture, drops it on the FTP server, builds it onto the thing, it notices a new file, kicks it out by email, by 3G.
Yeah.
You know, those scripting things, or the, you know, my site is down, but I don't want to pay for 3G bandwidth all the time.
I once deployed
a
video network right across a state in Australia, and its whole job was to just 24 hours a day monitor the substation to see if anybody walked on. We had to deploy an entire frame relay network that was separate from the main network so that anybody who was on the main network, so it could detect physical intrusions autonomously. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, if I had one of these on 3G and it just started recording when that event came off, that would be much more efficient.
Or even those footstep sensors you described.
Yeah.
Bury them in the dirt.
Awesome.
Well, I think you made a good comparison. Am I going to buy a T1, or do I want to pick up a DSL circuit that's cheap, and I'll buy a backup that's 3G?
Yeah.
Now you're looking at $150 a month instead of even postalized something around $500 a month.
Especially when you do something rural. Just getting the cable drawn into some of these locations is tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars for one pair.
Yeah, it might not be DSL service, and it might not even be T1 service. So then you're going to be stuck at broadband internet, and there might not even be broadband internet. Right?
And they do talk about satellite VPNs and IPsec VPNs, and I thought it was pretty great.
But on the box it says console server, which I think just wildly undersells what this thing's capable of.
They're
compared
humble
to almost any other console server.
They're very humble. They're very humble. Well, I think the point is that the bulk of their market is basically around consoles in the data center. As I said, they have this box which is 48. Console ports at $37 MSRP, done. But by mind, I was looking at that, and I'm paying Cyclades today, and I'm paying something like $80 a port, and I'm going, I'd rather have that than a Cyclades, because it's even the basic model had a hell of a lot more features than the one I'm getting from Cyclades today, because they're doing more with the Linux firmware, doing more with the LDAP and all that sort of stuff.
I think to your point, though, what do you call it? If you want to call it something, it's hard to market something that can do anything. I mean, I've seen that with different things. You know, we offer services to do whatever. You know, how does a salesperson go and market that? And that's a real challenge when you've got something. I think that's one thing that's sort of easy to associate it with, but it doesn't describe the full function.
The marketers promise the world, and in this case, OpenKit can promise the world because it can do mainly anything you think of. Actually, their marketers aren't lying.
But imagine the support problems. One of you guys asked them about support of all this stuff, and they said that it was no big deal because generally the people that are doing the crazier things with them are the very high-tech, very knowledgeable folks. You know, you start promising the world, does that open the door to a lot of people that maybe aren't as capable with this stuff and need a lot more help, you know?
I don't imagine they got too many support calls from the guys that invented the RFID salmon tracker.
No problem.
Got it working, that was it. They saved the config.
No, the support call was like, you guys want a picture of what we just did with this?
By the way, we need you to send us a new box in 2 months because the salt corrosion's about to eat this one alive.
That's right, yeah.
And the last thing I have to say is, if you're going to buy a piece of networking gear that fits that niche as everything becomes more ubiquitous, do you want to buy proprietary hardware, proprietary software, proprietary APIs, or do you want to buy a router that's running Linux?
Yeah. That's true. The other thing is Cisco makes a router in the same space, which is about three times the price, and nowhere near the capability and the flexibility. But that's a feature in its own right. If you're not Linux aware, or you haven't got that capability to encompass the whole of a solution, that iOS-based solution might work for you, but a Linux solution might work pretty well. Let's move on to talking a little bit more about Brocade, who we went to after Spirit. They had a lot to say. Very quickly, the Fabric. They talked very quickly about the Fabric stuff. That's the first time I think some of you guys have seen it. I've seen it several times. Any thoughts, Anthony?
I was impressed. It's Fabrics isn't something I deal with at the moment, and it's just for me, my it's on the grasp of my knowledge, and I was sort of hanging on with dear life to sort of keep up with it, and I found it very intriguing how there's what they're doing. I kind of it's hard for me because I am relatively new to the scene, but it's just there's exciting things to come. I was excited, and I can't technically describe what I saw. Watch the video to see a technical dive of it, but as you probably saw me, my jaw was like slobbering on the table, and I was just picking it back up. It's exciting things to come, really, and it's the same with SDN, like the second half of the presentation.
Sure. The beginning of that presentation of the fabric overview, you know, the key thing for me that, you know, I've seen some of this before, but it was still an eye opener. You look at this gear, looks like a bunch of Ethernet switches. No, this is a fabric. Layer 2 is a service here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what is the fabric? Is it like layer 1.5 then or something?
Trill.
You know?
It's a trill fabric with some port channel ASICs. Mm-hmm. Not demeaning it.
No.
But it's a simple Frank's fabric. Right.
To give you an idea of how easy Brocade is making fabric, I was getting text messages from a friend of mine who's a music teacher who was explaining this back to me in layman's terms and getting it. Yeah. So when we do this, this happens, right? Well, yeah, that's basically it. Oh, okay. If they can make it that easy for people to put things together, I mean, they were telling us, and I don't know if I should be telling a story or not, but they had a fabric deployment that they'd forgotten a password to. They didn't remember the management password, and they'd been running it for months. And they're like, well, you added switches to it since then. Well, yeah, we just plugged them in. They worked.
Yeah, the fabric thing for Brocade is a little bit different from the way Cisco's approached it. Brocade's using their FSPF routing protocol, but they're also using that to propagate configuration information between switches, as well as to handle things like DCP flow control and a whole bunch of stuff. And that's Uber Trill. That's Trill with extensions. Cisco's doing the same thing with Fabric Path, but they're not very far down that track. Brocade's doing it, as I said at the beginning of the presentation, they're focused on automation, ease of use, effortless networking is the thing that they're talking about. So what they're trying to do is literally make the network much less intrusive at an operational layer, finding ways for automated configuration to happen. So
that's been kind of their shtick for SANs for a long time, though.
That's why it's easy for them.
You know,
they've been doing it.
The whole idea of a SAN fabric or whatever that, you know, you plug it in, all the configuration information is passed along. Sure, it happens over fiber channel, but...
I'll throw a pause in that. I'll throw my stored CCI hat in here.
Yeah.
That is zoning. That's the protocol.
Yeah.
That, whether it's McData, whether it's Brocade, to be the same now, whether it's Cisco or insert XYZ here, that's just a feature of fiber channel. But it's not a feature of Brocade. And
absolutely. But they're implementing it in Ethernet. They're implementing it in their Ethernet switches.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, you know, Cisco implements configuration sharing using similar bands that they do. In their fiber channel platforms too.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what I think is good to see is that Brocade's grown past the roots of the acquisition. You know, there's a time when they're operating as two independent companies, and I can sense that their investments in ASICs designs are starting to come to a platform that is not the old company, but it's the new Brocade.
Yeah. That is true. And there's also vision. So we did talk about HyperEdge earlier, which is their campus stuff. It wasn't very exciting to us because I think most of us are sort of past campus networking. So
I've got to wonder, though, on the Trill side, and I hear the bit about it's Trill and only... it's standards-based, but it's FSPF instead of ISIS. And then you've got Cisco, who've done the same thing. They've taken Trill and said, it's not quite enough. We're going to make our own version. And you do start wondering, for fabrics as a whole, are we ever going to have interoperability? Is Trill actually enough? Or have two big vendors here just shown us that, no, that alone is not enough to get where the market is going to want to be?
Well, how do you define interoperability, and what is Optima interoperability? In my opinion, you're always going to have a domain. Whatever that domain is, it's highly optimized. And then generally, if I interoperate between customer, like if I'm a carrier, and that's just interoperating with a carrier, there's a boundary, you know, CSC boundary, and I operate in a very well-defined way that's not optimized to pass full features. I don't think we'll ever have a utopia where I can choose six different vendors, plug them in six different ways, and have them all work perfectly. I think that's unreasonable.
Do with OSPF,
well,
GP.
It'll dumb down to a... not as good if you plug it all together, and then maybe you had two pods that would interact together.
I think it's just
the standard model. You can't plug two vendors together without going dumbing down all the way, losing
absolutely
all of your features, you know, yeah, like, and that's, yeah, it would be nice if it was better than that.
I think it's the maturity of the protocols. I mean, OSPF's not always been fully interoperable. I think it's the maturity of the protocol.
I can remember when OSPF wasn't interoperable. Mm-hmm. So 1999, when mm-hmm I was deploying OSPF, Phase OSPF did Area Zero, mm-hmm, and then Cisco Invent came up with Areas. And, you know, that didn't settle out until, like, 2003, 2004. And then they came along with stubby areas. And then it was not so stubby, totally not so stubby, which is still Cisco proprietary today, right? So you don't actually have routing protocol compatibility even today. So to some extent, you know. But also, we are hopefully having a podcast with Radia Perlman in the next month or so, and I will ask her that question.
Very nice.
I love you some Radia.
Yeah.
Just a quick note on that. One of the things they said is that they sort of talked about their Trill-ish, you know, intelligent fabric. You got intelligence in the fabric. Splitting it. I don't think we'll need to wait for the point at which they standardize within the intelligent fabric. I think they said something toward the end, saying, well, yeah, but we're going to have VXLAN at the edge. I think that's where you're going to see the ability to bring in the competition, because you're going to have an intelligent edge, and you can then have dumb or relatively commoditized boxes with it, you know, as part of your transit between your edge nodes. You know, I think that's, I don't think we're going to end up with continue, you know, lots and lots of these super highly integrated intelligent fabrics. We're going to end up, eventually the market will move. They're giving us a solution for today, for what people are prepared to pay for today and what they want. But ultimately we're going to end up with something like VXLAN or some sort of intelligent edge. And then you can put cheap, you know, super cheap boxes as part of your layer 3 fabric, carrying whatever you want on it.
Well, it's already happening. I mean, it's being pushed down the virtualization,
yeah,
the virtualization layer, where those decisions belong.
Well, I think if we're throwing, the people in this room and the brilliant people listening to this podcast, if we're throwing in the towel and saying we're never going to get there, we're never going to get there.
Yeah, I think we've got to remember that ECMPs, Layer 2 ECMP or Trill or whatever form you want to call that, MLAGs or whatever, it's still got another 5 years to run before it becomes, you know, like we all know, finally, in 2012, 2010 really was when spanning tree stabilized, rapid spanning tree came along, PBST's now normal, you know, all those sorts of things. It took a decade. You know, I was still deploying, you know, spanning tree was kind of newish, sort of in the mid to late 90s. We didn't do a whole lot with it. We just kind of prayed that it worked. And really, it was only in the next, it took 10 years for a spanning tree to get stable and reliable and predictable, you know, with all the BPDU guards and the, you know, BPDU filtering and all those optimizations. So try not to get overrun with Trill and say, oh, it's not ready. Well, no, it's not. It's probably got a few more years before it achieves some sort of quasi functional
cap. I'll tell you right now, you know, Trill, Fabric Path, different implementations have solved design issues for me.
Yeah.
Right. And nothing's good for everyone, no, but I sure as heck love to have the tools in my toolbox.
Perfect. So let's move on to talking about OpenFlow and SDN, because we had a presentation there from Kurt Beckman, who is on the working group and talking about that sort of stuff. So, Brent, you obviously, you write a lot about OpenFlow and SDN. What did you think about that one?
No, I'll actually say something Stephen said on the way up. You know, hats off to Brocade for spending the whole second half of their presentation on something that's really this open standard. You know, and this is something that's good for everything and not just for Brocade. I was really impressed there. What definitely jumped out at me is something that I'm personally really interested in. It's a lot of people say, oh, there's this problem with the asynchronous nature of OpenFlow. It's a one-way push. There's no state being pulled either. It's capability of what the switch can do. It's extracting topologies. So he talked to us quite a bit about that. And so OpenFlow, OFConfig 1.1 is going to pick that up. It's out there. The spec, the proposal is out there. So anybody interested in it, definitely look at it, because we're starting to see this management plane shape up. There's a draft that was submitted around OVSDB, which is the database portion of Open vSwitch. So that obviously came out of the Nasir/VMware camp. But I think we're starting to see that plane shape up, and I see that as the vendor differentiation. If we can consolidate data planes, pretty solid. Control planes starting to look like it'll go the same way. The differentiation, which there's plenty of room in, is maybe going to be the management plane.
It
was mind-blowing for me.
Yeah.
I suppose that's a bit of quietness because it is, or at least I speak on my behalf. I followed it along since we had a podcast done back in a while back. You discussed it in depth, and it's nice to keep abreast of it. But for me, this was my first real sort of discussion in depth with people who are working with it or aware of it in far more detail than I am. And it rubs off. It makes logical sense. And my mind was mush at that stage, and it still was just impressive to see. This is what's going to be happening in 10 years' time. It's either get on board now or quit networking. Because it is logical, it's going to work, it's going to scale, and it will revolutionise what we do. Mm-hmm. It may cut jobs, it won't cut jobs.
It just changes the way we work around it.
Okay, sorry.
So here's how I see it. So just to address that question, because I get a lot of emails about that, OpenFlow changes us away from twiddling ports. So today we waste an awful lot of time going conf-t, ETH1, shut, no shut, VLAN, such and such. OpenFlow and everything that it drives above it at the SDN layer means that we can start getting into programming networks via APIs, and that means automated tools. So instead of us provisioning ports by hand, in the dark ages, getting a hoe out and going to, it's like a tractor for networking. You can go and up, plow a whole field in a day, what used to take 2 months. So that means your skills now step up. So you know this testing we talked about with Spirit, you never had time to do before?
Yeah.
You should now have time to do that.
So what about my level one people who do issue those commands? That essentially becomes an automated...
They will still have jobs that just
here's
run
the... Here's a book, start learning.
Okay.
Well,
cool.
Here's a hot tip from the Push podcast. Start learning.
Yeah.
Get on.
Well, Tom, I mean, you came out of the x86 industry pretty heavily, and so did you, Bob. So... When we started virtualizing x86, did we cut back on systems administrator? Hell no. There's more than ever.
Well, they became more. What happened was an evolution of the teams. And actually, I started running a dial-up service provider, but kind of dated myself. And quickly, built some very large data centers during the .com and all that BS. But absolutely, what we've seen with the advent of virtualization becoming commonplace was this evolution of formerly, our networks are built around T11, IEEE, and IETF protocols. And a lot of the talk, here, what about this MPLS feature? What about this OSPF feature? Is we become valuable in this field because we learn how to configure and design the protocols which glue things together. And what we've seen is on the system side is that's not as relevant anymore. What's relevant is the programmatic integration, what Greg just brought up. And I think I stood up on stage to my last company, too, 80 engineers and said, I know you became network engineers because you hate servers, but guess what? Cisco's come in the market, so get in it. It's a challenge that we're all going to be forced to face as network engineers is to expand that protocol knowledge to programmatic, to APIs, to programming language, to pick up Python, to pick up Ruby, to do the things some of us hate.
Actually, I'm not so sure. Well, I don't think that networking engineers will necessarily... They'll need to know some Python and some Ruby in the same way that you can get by today with some OSPF and some BGP. You don't actually have to be some, super skilled talent that knows BGP to the nth degree to be able to make it go for most use cases. I think that most network engineers will stand back from a management platform and have an awareness of how Ethernet and IP works, and you'll be able to say, this is what's happening, and the QoS and the... You won't necessarily need to know how Python pumps the API unless you want to be an extra specialist.
Yeah.
So it's not, you won't need to be perfectly competent on Python, but you will need to understand how Python achieves the output.
Well, an engineer versus an architect, right? So, we have a lot of people in this industry, your level one guys, their job is to do stuff. Just like there's maintenance developers, there are people new to this industry that actually write code. Right? And there's places for them too. There's a lot of them.
Yep.
And absolutely, if you're engineering, if your job, I want to integrate this application with this infrastructure in this way, well, someone has to make that happen.
Yep.
And an engineer that has an understanding of the hardware and the products and the protocols that are below that API layer is very, very, very valuable.
And there's going to be, because I would go as far as say, you're not going to need to, if you know Expect or Perl today, then you're probably that kind of guy that's going to want to get under the hood. But there's going to be applications. Go look at your wireless controllers today. That's your global view. You look at everything that's out there. I think that's exactly what it's going to look like here. If there's going to be more abstraction. I mean, how many of us can say our TE policy, our QoS policy security policies are good at our shops, and really can say that without
QS policy, no email.
But if we had more time to work on this, and that's what I think is, that's
what's exactly
going to happen.
It. Yeah. You know, that's what's happening in the system side. I can speak from the system side. You know, and this is sort of a corollary to what you're saying, Colin. The you know, it frees. Well, and I say this to my teams where I work as well. You know, people are worried about, oh, you know, we're going to automate ourselves out of a job. No, there's so much work to be done that we're automating ourselves into more interesting things, you know, into things that actually move us forward as an organization rather than just trying to keep up.
It's based on, it's like, is it fear or growth? You know what I mean?
Let's start with the growth.
If you've got a static industry, then the fear is warranted. You know, if I've got a static industry where nothing changes, nothing moves, nothing grows, then yes, automating jobs that you do now would result in redundancies. But that's not the case, and that is no... Does anybody see a future in which we're not going to grow? You're going to take the problem that you're doing today that's going to be boring tomorrow.
Yep.
You script it, you abstract it, you know, you move on. A new challenge comes, you know, the next day, and then you try and figure out how to deal with that.
Yeah.
That's just the way it's going to roll.
Well, that's the way IT works, is, you know, by the time you get one problem figured out, somebody's invented all new problems.
I'd like to congratulate the virtualization industry for catching up with networking.
Yes.
As I started... I started configuring virtual LANs in 2001. You know?
Well, IBM kind of did that. Yeah, we can all talk back to IBM and mainframes.
Oh, I've got some mainframe guys that keep making snide remarks about.
Well, I think a really interesting thing, though, and the challenge that a lot of us are all facing is, you know, our end users, the business parts, as IT, we become increasingly disconnected from the business that we're in. And the fact is, the people that make money in the business and drive it forward, who create and sell the product that your company makes, they can choose to consume from you or from someone else. And the, you know, a lot of CIOs and IT shops that accept that, as they see their workloads moving up to the cloud, in air quotes, you know, I hate talking about cloud, but really these IT shops are having to take those same operational methodologies, these DevOps methodologies, that the service providers they're competing with to become efficient, to be able to allow themselves to be able to solve problems just like, you know, the box.nets of the world.
That's probably a good point to segue into the OpenStack discussion. So after we'd spoken about OpenFlow for a little while, Brocade, a couple of the guys there, Sandeep and those guys, stood up and gave us a demo of their OpenStack integration. Now, I'm on the record as saying I think that in the long run we're going to see two virtualization products in the world. One will be VMware, which is the commercial paid for, and there'll be a free version, which is probably going to be OpenStack. So every time I see OpenStack, I get more and more excited about that. Who wants to lead off there?
I can start.
You're an OpenStack committer. You could start.
Yeah, I'm a contributor. You know, I'm speaking next week at OpenStack Summit. You know, it was really interesting. I hadn't reviewed their code until they submitted it, and I was like, wow, I feel kind of like a butthead, because, you know, while I may have my own opinions of technology, I love to learn. And you know, they had, I was talking with the team before they came up, and, you know, they've been going through a lot of challenges that a lot of companies, and both IT and manufacturers, are facing. It's like, okay, how do we get through legal to commit? How do we get people to understand that contributing to these open source, that the world is changing? And they've finally been able to get through this and committed their code October 9th, just a couple days ago. It was reviewing the code when they first, as a result, it was kind of quiet when they were first speaking. And what they've managed to do in a very simple way, and I think it actually talks to the elegance of OpenStack right now and Quantum, is, you know, by utilizing SSH and netconf, they've been able to push down and integrate with, you know, we saw the demonstration. There's a demonstration of launching instances via Horizon, but they are able to create software-defined networks, or, you know, a software-defined consumption of networks, utilizing their brand-new products with a small team, adding significant value. And, yeah, I mean, the code probably needs a little review. It could be tightened up a little bit, but it's absolutely functional.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting to see Brocade work, because they kind of come from a different angle.
Yeah.
You know, they come from this fiber channel network world, and they're coming into this Ethernet world, and they do have a unique perspective. I'm really interested to see where they grow past this.
Yeah.
I will add, though, your sort of bifurcated view of the virtualization world, I think, needs a try instead of a buy there because you're forgetting about Microsoft and Hyper-V.
I agree with you. Server 12?
Yeah. There's still Zen out there. There's Zen Server. There's a lot of people using Zen Server. But Microsoft is a juggernaut, you know, and they, yeah, don't count them out.
I did.
You're making a mistake.
The price will be right.
But that's
the price
thing,
will be right for a few years, and then they'll come and stick it to you.
Yeah, that may be the case. But VMware's sticking it to people right now.
That's why OpenStack
and Hyper-V have the door open for them right now.
So you really want to blow your mind, though? You know, so just sit on an OpenStack-meeting. Sit on their team meetings. Microsoft has a buttload of money. Look at Bing. How many? It's got to be in the billions a year they're losing in that thing. Or I don't know. It's obnoxious. And, you know, they've copied Xen. Excuse me. They've implemented a hypervisor based off the Xen reference implementation. Right?
Embrace and extend, I believe.
Yeah. This is the same hypervisor that the multi-billion dollar cloud that Amazon's running uses, right, in the guts. And they have really good hooks and integrations into SCOM. And you forget that people buy infrastructure because of applications that run on it. And whether you like them or not, Microsoft's there in all of our customers. I totally agree with you that we will see on commercial products, we will see VMware and Hyper-V everywhere, especially in the 1,000 users and below market.
The announcements this week from VMworld Barcelona was that vCenter is going to start managing Hyper-V, you know, along with the normal ESX stuff, you know. So
has to.
Yeah, that's a big
indicator. What I'm saying there is that Hyper-V as a hypervisor, not as a platform.
Yes, I
see VMware as so this OpenStack and VMware right up here at the top. They're platform management systems.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yep.
But
and OpenStack might manage Hyper-V, and VMware might manage Hyper-V, but it won't be Hyper-V as the
when you're
clicking to create it. It's not Hyper-V that you're clicking into.
People will vote with their wallets, and right now it's easy to vote Microsoft with your wallets, especially.
I think most people aren't willing to commit. Most corporate companies I'm working with aren't willing to commit to Microsoft anymore.
Microsoft's nipping at the heels of VMware. They have for years, and the gap is closing. But has VMware ever been under pressure to perform? Not if they are really under the thumb, they'll accelerate. They'll blow us out of the box and jump back ahead. They'll leave Microsoft behind.
They're starting to feel it.
But they'll do. They'll revolutionise what their business and they'll move forward again. They've done it once before. They broke ahead and they were the only virtualization where you'd actually consider. Everyone else used to get laughed at for using something
VMware,
else.
VMware,
and they'll do it again.
Yeah, all I'm going to say is that they're starting to think about IT is a holistic problem rather than just hypervisors, and I think that's where VMware is going to start dominating again.
The first push is not putting V in front of everything.
So what you're saying is you're going to have Microsoft competing against a shinier, more expensive competitor, while a smaller vocal minority wraps themselves around open source.
I mean,
this sounds so familiar.
I see penguins dancing by.
I know, right?
Yes. I think that
or a Star Trek
too.
Movie. I
think there's
know.
Only room for
a
paid
Star
product
movie.
And a free product.
Well, I think
the same reason that we've only got Microsoft and Linux in the data center, excepting for a few niche boutique systems running on HBox or AIX or you know mainframe.
There's always two.
Yeah.
But I think the most interesting thing about it is, and we're all networking nerds, especially Tom. He is the networking nerd. But what we've seen is, it's pretty amazing to witness, there's been storage pretty well virtualized. There's been compute pretty damn well virtualized. Obviously, they're well ahead. Decomposed down to resources to be consumed.
Mm-hmm.
This is networking decomposed into resources being consumed. So it's finally the alignment of business and IT, not just at hyperscale, is what I think we'll see a trend towards.
So this is the third OpenStack demo I've seen this week from vendors. The other two I can't talk about because they're under embargo, but fascinating to see. Just fascinating to see what we're going to happen in that space because I think OpenStack's going to... By the way, don't rush out and start deploying OpenStack in production.
Thank you.
Right? What I'm saying is that it's still got a year or two to run.
I'd say it depends on the market. So, I mean, I've been down and dirty in it. If you're trying to bring some workloads back from Amazon right now, you can start to bring some back today. And like if you're a web service provider, you need to be a service provider and contributing code right now. With the real positive sign that happened was really Red Hat and Suzy. And Ubuntu becoming distributors because the massive developers behind that and the productization is huge. And Grizzly, I think, will be start to say to Grizzly being in 6 months. I'll be this spring.
for like the general enterprise people. Start bringing in your environment, start learning about it, and then probably that next fall. We're seeing there's an interesting post, and I wish I could say the link off the top of my head, about the pace of development. So the way the 6 months release cycle, what's happening is compressing a year's worth of work down to 6 months. It's really amazing at the velocity features are coming out.
Well, I think the trick here is that the larger cloud providers like Rackspace and, you know, and there's any number of yourself and the vendors are all starting to contribute code into OpenStack. Yeah. Now, that's a level of participation that Linux, for example, as a kernel, has taken years to build up that community. But there's a real pressure for the vendors to get into OpenStack because it doesn't cost much and it doesn't take a whole lot of resources. As you say, Brocade's put a small team together to commit a certain amount of code, and a significant amount of that work was getting past legal.
Exactly. And, you know, if you talk to some of the large, you know, talking to living in Silicon Valley, it's interesting some of the conversations you have. I was talking to one senior VP of a large storage company, not based on this coast, but out here for a time, and the biggest threat to his business, and we're on the large, is actually Amazon. Right, and so all these infrastructure vendors are seeing their dollars walk out the door, and I think what the reason you're seeing all these people who sell stuff come together to develop to freely contribute code is to create an alternative to Amazon that gives people an excuse to buy their stuff and put it in a data center.
That'd be a good reason.
And now I personally think now, so underneath the hood of all this, these are all very stable, open source, been around a long time. KVM is a hypervisor that's been upstream for years. So the components...
That's what using.
Right. And so the components are solid. And now's as good a time as any to start looking at it. Because the future is... we've been talking about Elastic Cloud for how long? We'll move workloads to the cloud, and it's going to be as brokers, but this is really the first time we really start seeing, here is an API. Here's a RESTful call to push workloads one way or another.
Well, and functionally, what we're actually... And this is really... I kind of had like an eye-opener a couple hackathons ago. We're trying to extend storage QoS to make it so you can go through Horizon, and if you instantiated a VM, that you'd be able to give it a preference in multiple VMs, give preferences they accessed disk I.O. Right, and it actually worked out where there was someone's from Adtran, someone's from Cisco, someone's from Nexus, my company. Broca guys weren't there, and they came a couple weeks after. And infrastructure architects from Yahoo and some of the architects from PayPal, eBay, PayPal, and Dell. And we actually did functionally. We came to an extension of the API. There's a few APIs inside of this, but we're able to all find. It's becoming the ITF for cloud, where are these APIs not argued about, but actually defined and created.
And the big question for me is, does networking follow and trace? Are we going
to
start seeing this?
Has to.
And so I fully expect us to have something that's going to be along these lines in the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay, so you probably bored ourselves witless with OpenStack and the Quantum plugin. So let's move on to some current news. We picked out a couple of quick topics this week. We saw an announcement from Cisco on their blog sites from Gary Kinghorn talking about the Nexus 1000V going to a freemium pricing model. Basically, what that means is that there's a limited feature set that's available for free. Everybody can deploy it into their VMware stack. And then for a nominal fee, I'm sure it's very reasonable, you can upgrade to a fully featured version of Nexus 1000V. If you've been following some of the other podcasts, so Cisco sponsored a number of podcasts on the Packet Pushers over the last 6 weeks. We've published a set of discussions with Prashant Gandhi and Han Yang previously, where we went to Cisco Live, talking about how Nexus 1000V product works and how it's moving away from just becoming a switch to actually being a platform on which they can deploy multiple layers of services. So in the last conversation we had with Prashant Gandhi, where he was talking about the vPath 2.0, where Cisco's actually carved a data path through the VMware kernel, and onto that we can now start to stack virtual security gateways or virtual firewalls or deviate into a virtual ASA. Down the pipe will be coming VWAS, so you can actually terminate a WAS in front of a hypervisor. And the third-party companies now, there was recently an announcement on Cisco blog that from Imperva, who makes a WAF, web application firewall, that could actually be put in front of web servers inside of a virtualization stack.
So depending on when you're listening to this particular podcast, I've either already said this or I will say this in a couple of weeks. This is primarily a move to head off whatever Nicira is going to be doing.
Yeah.
Because before, the Nexus 1000V argument was pretty easy. either you want the stupid unmanaged layer 2 switch that VMware gives you, or you want something that's useful. But now that Nicira is on the verge of having a product that you can put in there, Cisco's got to put something down to be able to head off the oncoming rush to the integrated product. So it's a lot harder to dislodge a switch than it is to make a choice between two.
Yeah, I hate to say it, though. You know, your derogatory comments towards the stupid vSwitch, which I agree, it is stupid, but, you know, Cisco is a level of complexity by itself that many organizations don't need. You know, some organizations do need. You know, and whether, you know, whether they choose now with vSphere 5.1, there's enough functionality in these stupid vSwitches and slightly less stupid distributed vSwitches that, they might be good, they might continue to be good enough in the face of still a complicated Cisco switch where you're going to need training, you're going to need
I'll throw in right in there that if you look at, and one of the reasons Hyper-V is free now is because distributed vSwitch is good,
mm-hmm.
This is a fully functional switch that operates in software,
yeah.
And that if you want to have consistency in your UI, well, hey, you have a choice, and you know, I'm paying extra,
yeah.
and they start layering on the other cool stuff.
Oh yeah, well, and the VSG, you know, the security gateway that you can get now as part of the advanced. What is it? It's called Essentials is the free one,
yeah.
And Advanced is the one. I don't know what the cost is. It's probably giant, but you get VSG as part of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's definitely a value add. You know, and that competes directly with some of VMware's offerings and things like that. And I don't know. There's a value proposition there for some people. For a lot of people, there isn't. You know,
Flankers, I come from you and your server,
I know,
and Ken,
crap, dude,
and all that. But at the end of the day, the networking team won't trust a switch they can't telnet into. And that's where vSwitch dies for them. It's like, guess what?
Yeah.
This is a little thing with ports on it, and I can't do anything beyond tag a VLAN on it.
So let me tell you, as somebody who's deploying FlexPods,
mm-hmm.
there are no switches. In a FlexPod, I've got, currently I have a server farm that has 320 blades, and the only switches that are in there is two FIs at the top of the rack.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Two 48-port switches, and out of those 48 ports, there's only 32 ports that are not fiber channel. So there's 16 ports going right to my fiber channel. There are no switches to telnet to. Everything's done in the UCS, and the only Ethernet is right at the top. And that's all controlled by UCS Manager. The only Ethernet that breaks out of that stack is the 4x10s that go up to my Nexus 7000 in my legacy core.
You're making people twitch at home, man.
I know.
Well, I think there's one thing that we can all agree on is that VMware is going to have a really good networking product with Martin Quesada and Ben Fab and really smart. It's great for us because it's going to force better products.
It goes right back to that discussion.
Yeah,
a networking engineer cannot afford to have lack knowledge in the system's virtualization layer.
Yeah.
It is a part of your network, whether you like it or not.
Let me just take the discussion one more level up. I want to just wait. Nicira today is a software switch that's externally programmed from a controller. But Nicira is also a platform. It's a service, network service platform. In the same way that VPath allows firewalls and WAFs and everything, which a product that Cisco's been building for 3 years and very slow to embrace because they didn't want to upset anybody in the networking industry, Nicira is also a platform. And they will also bring firewalls. You'll see vShield gone, and it will be replaced by something in this era. Maybe the management console will look the same, but they'll have a firewall down in that.
You'll start to see software-defined networking paths for storage first, just judging by some check-ins I've been watching, or people patching up some code. I think with all the IP that's being transferred from EMC right now, But absolutely, you know, and also gives VMware a platform where they can start to leverage all these companies they've bought and built, and leverage it on public cloud providers.
Yeah, Nicira is a platform. Don't miss it. It's just today. It's just a switch, and it'll replace the vSwitch. I mean, and let's face it, VMware's networking team really let them down because so far VMware's networking is around about 2006.
Linux bridging.
Yeah, we finally have LACP, you know. Holy crap, you know.
Bring it all!
How long have you guys had LACP?
You know?
But Plankers, you were saying...
45 years now or something?
You were saying that with wide networking in a switch with a 1000V, for example, you need some specialist skills. If you've got a half decent VMware deployment, you've got a network team, or you've got so they should be capable.
Well, but you can have half decent small VMware deployments too. You know, like you're just talking about scale. You know, like
but if you're
I've got a network team.
If you're using distributed vSwitch, you're going to have a network team up further up to be doing other network stuff more than likely.
Yeah.
But also as well, you've got with the freemium model, you've got companies like where I'm at, where we use the vSwitch through for simplicity methods.
Yeah.
But I can actually look now and considering the 1000V, because its feature set is on par with the vSwitch and distributed vSwitch, I do the same things with the freemium, and I can actually seriously deploy something where we can gain much more control.
Agreed.
And we can do so much more.
Agreed.
And it's a freemium model. I'm not obliged to buy from Cisco. If I buy it, I get the VSG, and I get support. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, that's all you're paying for. So with a freemium model, they're gaining a foothold because we can actually try it out in a lab and go, this actually works. I deal with Nexus 2Ks and 5Ks further up from the VMware anyway, so why not push a 1K to replace the vSwitch, which generates BPUs and does really silly stuff, which we've all been burnt by, generating BPUs when it shouldn't, and then all of a sudden you lose the whole cluster. It does silly things because it's poorly designed, and I'm going to be shot down by VMware guys, I think. But a vSwitch is pretty average. It doesn't seem logical.
BPDU filter is a new feature in vSphere 5.1.
There's an example, and that should be.
Yeah.
It's been around for years.
Mm-hmm.
And it does affect the span tree topology. It does all this stuff, but it's only now they're protecting their asses.
Yeah.
And the thing is, a number of outages being caused by VMware, I'm probably getting a bit too passionate now, is that this could have been avoided years ago, and it shows how they don't care about networking.
Well, some of it might be a system design problem.
No, it's an organizational structure where you have a networking team, systems team who aren't designing a network together.
I've got $1.3 billion of reasons why they do care about networking.
I've been blessed in my organization that I've got network guys that are willing to work with me, even so far to say that they don't care about the virtual switches or whatever, and that frees us to make a decision about things. You know, we haven't been fighting about
things.
I am so going
to have to come down and talk to your network engineers.
Yeah,
that is just not on.
Yeah,
God will come down.
Get them fired up.
Get them
all
hostile.
You bring pitchforks and torches with people. So, no, like, yes. So, thanks,
Greg. Okay, that's all right. I think it's interesting in the fact that even with the Nexus 1003 freemium license, I still don't... I've been to a couple of VMware designs recently and haven't been able to justify buying it or even deploying it just because it seems like such a pain to put in. It's just another thing to go wrong.
I feel the same way about it. I've worked in one environment that opted to buy it, a very large environment, and you know the argument about now the network team has visibility into the vSwitch just doesn't resonate with me.
No,
I've got to get more value
than just it's a Cisco switch.
Well, because there are no access ports, you don't need to log in and configure anything, so you never touch it. The one benefit they got out of it was LACP. That was the thing that was
going on. Well, I think if you look at, you know, and hopefully this is an NDA, but if it is, oh well. You know, there's a trend from our favorite networking manufacturer, Off Tasman, taking appliances and making them virtual, and then making things do magic in the virtual layers. And I think what you'll continue to see is not as we both enabled the 1000V to work on multiple hypervisors, but as I think you actually mentioned, so I'll just copy what you said, of VWAS, of not VACE anymore, but
they haven't actually announced the death of the VACE.
Well, that's
announced the death of the hardware platform.
I think that the channel has decided on that death, by the way. The channel already decided on that death. I think customers have too. But with all these services that are going down inside of here, you know, with VPath 2.0, I think what we'll see is things that we're doing will work better and faster.
So that's
the other reason.
One place where Nexus will work is if you actually do have Hyper-V and KVM. Where you're going to use Open vSwitch and you've got VMware and you want to have a consistent networking strategy across all those devices.
Well, and to your discussion of what we're probably going to see is, you know, the high expensive stuff for certain workloads and the free open source stuff for the rest of them. And, you know, at that point, you know, consistency in your operational procedures is very important. What the 1000V will bring to you is a consistency in your network edge.
Sure. Okay, so moving on to today's comedy piece of gold is John Chambers in an argument on CRN released a post talking about where we're going, where we compete, we're going to win. And he's talking about VMware buying Nocera and competing against VMware, which runs right on from the last piece. Of course, I popped out a tweet which said that that's pretty funny because Cisco always competes to win with products like the Ace, the WAS, the Flip, you know, all those CS Mars where they want to become the CS tablet. So aside from those places where competing didn't quite work out so great, does anybody think that Cisco is going to be able to beat out VMware?
They're competing against the Gullible. They're winning the Gullible. So they are winning at something.
Yeah.
So some of those products
are good attempt to rewrite history.
Is there a big company? They have some smart people. Whether they can pull those smart people together to create good products or not, you know, I guess remains to be seen. I'm sure VMware is not scared by any of the posturing that Chambers did today, you know, like,
but it is just that, isn't it? It's a sound bite, you know, it's just like, what you say you will do is immaterial. Are you going to compete or not? You know, I guess
when we actually see a product,
if you're working for VCE today, you know, the joint venture between EMC and Cisco, how do you be feeling?
I feel great after I got my LinkedIn updated. This is like that scene at the end of the movie when the hero and the villain walk up and they shake hands, but they got their hands on their guns. And the ominous music starts playing in the background, and you know something's just about to go down. That's basically what they're doing. They're trying to play nice with the EMC to keep VCE running for a little while longer, and then they're getting ready to go to war with Nocera, knowing what's going on. I wouldn't be surprised if Cisco didn't go out and say, you know what, we need a virtualization company, let's just buy Citrix.
Look at Microsoft, though. They're a sleeping giant. I believe Microsoft, I've got a respect for Microsoft, don't hate me. When they want to do something and they are passionate about it, they will do it and do it well. It hasn't happened since Windows 7 and before that, maybe XP, but it hasn't happened for a while. Since Balmer's come on board, it's gone average, and we all can admit that. And there was, but you went, yeah, exactly, like the motion towards a lower latitude. But you find that, I believe, Cisco, their gears of war are slowly winding up. Yeah, the beast is awakening, and they'll do so, when they actually get a cohesive thing, they'll do something right.
Windows 8 is going to kill them.
Yeah, Windows 8 will kill them, but they'll do something after.
But on the client, but Windows 8 on server 2012 is really good.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, and I believe.
Yeah, because you don't have to.
All right, everybody shout down Greg. Who thinks server 2012 is really good?
Terrible. Who thinks that Microsoft investing in software development and .NET developers for their past solutions, which end up driving consumption of Server 2012, is going to be a differentiator? So what's VMware doing in that space?
It's a sleeping giant. The gears of war are moving. They're grinding. It's a bit of noise.
Yeah, people have been saying that.
Did you just say VDI?
No, but it's different this time.
All right.
And I'll tell you why.
We'll hold Foskett to that.
Yeah, I didn't announce myself. It's different this time because Microsoft Server 2012 is not just the next generation of Windows or the next generation of Windows Server. It is a hypervisor-directed and hypervisor-integrated operating system. It's the next generation of server operating system.
VMware
GSX. And everything that I look at in Server 2012, I keep having the same question. Why didn't the Linux guys do this? You know?
The big statement.
It's really good. And it's not just
the
next version of server. It's good because it's integrated with Hyper-V. It has all sorts of advanced features to tunnel through the hypervisor and do cool stuff through the hypervisor.
Fiber channel.
It's a good product.
So, back to what is it Cisco's going to do? So they've got millions invested in R&D into UCS.
Mm-hmm.
So do they go after the next layer, which is orchestration? Because I think that's the decision they've got to make. Mm-hmm. They've been quite successful, even though everybody thought they weren't going to be with UCS. Yeah. So I think that's
maybe arms
the
dealer.
Flip comment about buying Citrix isn't all that flip, you know?
It's not. When you're sitting on a mountain of cash and you have to make a play, getting desperate makes things make a lot more sense than they did two weeks ago.
VMware forced their hand with the acquisition when they probably weren't ready to do
it. Well, the rumor is they got outbid for it. They were going after Nocera, and they put up a bunch of money, and VMware said, here's more.
What was it, $1.2 billion for 40 people?
Yeah. For the X1000 A team.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Martin Casado is worth at least $750 million of that.
Now,
so.
It's more complex than that. I think that Cisco's a big company. They've got multiple divisions. We, you know, for all that we might poke some fun at some divisions which perhaps aren't performing in stellar, you know, the UCS division's done a great job.
Yeah.
The Nexus 7000 is, you know, hasn't not such a great product. It's a few years late. The code bug's a bit bad. You know, the CIS security team hasn't necessarily performed as well as you might like. You look at those, the set, the ASA, still innovating to some extent, but Ironport and the ScanSafe acquisitions haven't exactly hit the headlines very often. I don't know how many people have used those products.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but so Cisco owns 20% of VMware, right?
5%.
Oh, is it only 5? Does that 25. Does that allow them to IP?
Yep.
Okay.
And Cisco owns 5, and Intel owns 15, and then EMC owns the other 8.
It's an EMC company.
It's a public company.
Yeah.
It's a public company that's owned by those three people.
But leadership-wise, it's an EMC company.
Yeah. That's right. Now it's very much so.
If we've talked to any VMware sales guys recently, it's an EMC company.
Yeah. So do the gloves come off and they go to war with VMware and best man wins?
Well, you've got to look at the fact that EMC's partnered with Lenovo recently. The overt statements around Lenovo is that EMC is now building a lot of big data appliances and analytics. They've bought some software acquisitions. This allows them to partner with them for server vendor, so which makes you wonder why they didn't partner with Cisco for those servers, perhaps, if the relationship's so great. And then EMC's made a big noise about the fact that they're partnering with Lenovo to go into China. But when Lenovo comes and presents to me, they're saying it's fantastic, it's a worldwide relationship, they can't wait to partner with EMC in Europe and America. So a little bit of cross-messaging going on there. You know, is EMC going to get some OEM servers from Lenovo and bring their own to market? Very possible. Hard to know.
I think what's happening in the storage space is that, you know, there's this huge move from things that classically look like storage arrays to things that look a lot like servers.
Yeah.
Things that actually are servers that do storagey stuff.
It's great.
And the technologies are going that distributed.
It's going to this converged, hyper-converged solution.
What is it, the Nutanix scale computing?
Yeah. It's the same thing. If you look at the tech previews for VMware, you know, VMware vSAN implements effectively Isilon's different code, but it implements Isilon inside the chassis, and there you guys use Avamar code to back it up that's built into VMware now. And, you know, the leadership, so they did the white swap and they put Gelsinger over there. You know, I think everyone thinks about the EMC versus Cisco. Frankly, they're just trying to do what they need to do to survive in a highly competitive market and survive that transition to server-based computing. And while everyone loves to talk about, you know, Chambers and Tucci, who have a really good relationship, or EMC and Cisco not getting along and VMware and Cisco not getting along, frankly, in this transition to server-based computing, if you install VMware on Cisco, it drives a whole bunch of business for Cisco.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it. And you know, my gut feel looking at Cisco, while it could all go to hell, right, that in the best, if you look at the total addressable market for servers, it's giant, and Cisco obviously is getting into it in a serious way, that, you know, Cisco is going to, Microsoft, yeah, works great on Cisco. VMware, yeah, works great on Cisco. OpenStack, yeah, we contribute to it, and works great on Cisco. As long as you buy Cisco, they're happy.
Maybe that's what he defines as winning.
Absolutely, making money.
Yeah, making money is definitely winning.
Isn't winning a point of view? But seriously, how do you...
Generally, it aligns with making money.
Measure.
Winning is a point of view.
Buckets of cash, I'm winning.
By having a market share may not mean I make the most money, but I'm winning from that point of view. It depends on what the business goals are of the internal Cisco hierarchy and the walking gods that they seem to be. That they believe their point of view could be this, and we were thinking it's money, we could be off the mark. Chambers may have already won. And really, it's in our point of view, and their point of view.
They're tiger blood.
More often than not, they're not aligned.
I think it's true that the market's in transition. So the old lines where Cisco had the network and HP had the servers, and Dell and HP and IBM ran servers, and, you know, then there was...
That's why silos in corporations and in enterprises and that don't work anymore.
It's hard to see.
They don't work in the tech industry anymore.
And so what I think what I reflect in my mind is sometimes I see Cisco, who's my main business partner in terms of a professional career, isn't necessarily doing winning clearly like they've always done. And you have these moments of uncertainty where you don't see what the future looks like. Cisco's innovating on, you know, like a dozen fronts. So they've got security, they've got video conferencing.
Don't mention flip.
Yeah.
The reality is, though, when you look at Chambers' statement, it's such a ridiculous thing to say.
Yeah.
And it's not meant for us, anyway.
No,
you make a statement like that, that's to try and keep your stock price up and keep the investors
happy.
That's
for Wall Street.
It's so general.
Who'll forget?
Where we compete, we win. I'm really, what about it?
We're going to forget about next week.
They're probably laughing at it, too, you know? Like,
Okay, well, I think we'll call it a show this week and wrap it up. As always, you can find the Packet Pushers on their website at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on the Twitter as @PacketPushers. I think we even have a Facebook page. I get an email from it every now and then, but you can go and follow us there. As always, you can send feedback on today's show to packetpushers@gmail.com. I apologise if we haven't gotten back to you in the last couple of weeks. Both Ethan and I have been fairly busy. We do have day jobs, and ultimately this is a hobby. Speaking of things day jobs and hobby-like, you can give us a donation over PayPal. There's a button on the website if you'd like to help us out. Don't forget to take some time if you are a blogger and you'd like to contribute to the discussion. All the guys here, many of them write occasionally on the packetpushers.net website. If you too would like to blog, please don't hesitate to email us and we'll get you signed up so that you can share your opinions with the community. As always, remember that too much networking
would never be enough.
Perfect. Didn't even have to say it.